Welcome, everybody. I want to start by telling a little bit of the narrative of how we got to this particular four words. Because I've had conversations with several of you over different periods of time. I met with the summer community last summer and had several little talks on the ARC with Scott and Kristen. And I've talked with Janet and Diane and Hanifa and various people. And basically, this is a convergence of some different things which I think are summed up in this phrase. One is Holden's commitment to the environment, okay, and to ecology, which we all know is there. But I think we don't speak it always with as much clarity as the world needs. We speak it with some clarity, but it's really getting to be an urgent need. And I must say that some sessions I went to last summer raised that on my own priority list. And I really kind of had a conversion experience on global warming. And you know, I knew these things, but when you really feel that, and the way that our kitchen is addressing that, and so on, I think is really important, and a gift to the church, which Holden almost uniquely can offer to the church and to the world. Okay, there are lots of people working on lots of issues in lots of places, but this one seems to me to be a special call to this place. Some of the other conversations that we had about the theme grew out of last year's theme, which was Summon Out What We Shall Be, and was about vocation. And we were all listening for our calls. But there was one aspect of that I hope we could lift up a little bit more this year, and that was work, and the work that all of you do in the village to receive people, to keep it going. In one sense, human labor is our form of engagement with the natural world. When you get energy from it and so on, it's this human work and its engagement. How we do that is related to ecology. But then, whenever we talked about work, it got very serious. And people were saying, what about rest? What about rest? You know? So yeah, what about rest? You know, that's important too. 6 days of work, one of rest. And there are rhythms then in our life together here and really in the life of the natural world as it rotates and goes through seasons and so on, which are both relevant to ecology and relevant to our life together in community here and in work. And we name those rhythms in the rhythms of worship. Okay? And gathering for worship, we acknowledge that our work and our rest is in God's hands. We let go of our cares at the end of the day. We trust God as we go to sleep. So worship, work, ecology, it's a kind of a heady mix. So I was really struggling with this and talking to lots of people. Came out here to the wonderful conference in the fall, Sacred Time, Holy Ground. And many of these themes were also joined in that particular conference. Ecology and liturgy, how we worship and how we live upon the earth, and how we can make that link more vivid and vital and motivating for all of us. So we're thinking about sacred time, holy ground. That's kind of abstract. Then there's standing on holy ground. And then there's aha, that first command that comes out of the burning bush to Moses. Just take off your shoes. You are standing on holy ground. It's in Exodus 3. And that's the text that we're going to look at this evening. Okay, I think it weaves together a lot of Holden's central concerns that I'm really excited about lifting it up. I also think it has great potential in the t-shirt department, the 4th of July float department, and it's a vivid and concrete image. I get a little worried when people talk about, you know, tape off your clothes, or, you know, all the different things you could come up with, but we'll live together with all of this. So, you live. Silly, I hope, but also really profound when we read it within our biblical setting. And in a sense, an image of the stance that we as human beings can have on the earth as we respond to a surprising call from God, which turns out to be a call to go back down the mountain and work for liberation. Okay, that's the call to most. So let's look at this. Would you follow along? And I'm going to ask somebody to read it, but let me first kind of set up the story, and I'm sure we all know this, but remind you of what's going on in Exodus when we come to this passage, okay? We're going to be at the beginning of the third chapter of Exodus. And let's just remember that at the end of Genesis, that the 12 sons of Jacob and Jacob himself and all of their large families have come to Egypt because there was famine. They came looking for food, found their brother Joseph there ruling, and found food there. End of Genesis. Okay, beginning of Exodus. They settle down. They're very prosperous and productive people. They have many more generations, many more children. They become a strong people. The Egyptians get threatened and put taskmasters over them to oppress them. Okay, and have them making bricks for the pharaohs and laboring under oppression. But this doesn't stop them. They're still a prosperous and strong people, and the Egyptians are threatened. And so the command goes out from the Pharaoh that the midwives are to kill all the sons that are born. And the midwives are some of the first resisting women in the Bible. And they, no, not all the first, but there's some important resisting women in the Bible. And they say they just don't do it. They refuse to follow this command. They tell Pharaoh, well, we can't help it. The Israelite women are so strong that the babies pop out before we can ever get there. So then Pharaoh puts the command to the mothers themselves. You must throw all of your sons into the Nile. And I don't know how many of them responded, but at least one that we know of resisted and nursed her child for a while. Hid him, but when he started to get so big she couldn't hide him anymore, she put him in a basket of papyrus and floated him on the Nile, and Pharaoh's daughter found him, right? Got the mother as a wet nurse to help her raise this boy, and then took the boy into Pharaoh's house. This is Moses, okay? The liberator of the people. So Moses rises up, but he still knows he's a Hebrew. He sees a Hebrew being oppressed. He goes out and actually kills the overseer who was beating up the slaves and has to run then for his life lest he be sentenced for murder, has to run into the wilderness. In the wilderness, he's at a well. He meets these young women who turn out to have a father. He helps them out, marries one of the daughters, and that's where we find him. He's watching the flock of his father-in-law, okay? And he's just out grazing the sheep, following them around. He's in major transition. You know, he's running from the law, okay? But going about his daily on the land. Okay, so this is Moses. Not yet a famous guy, but out there just going about a fairly everyday kind of labor, doing his work out in the wilderness with his sheep. So would someone read just that first six verses, and then we're going to work through it together after we hear the whole story.
Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. There the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, and he said, Here I am. Then he said, Come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. He said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God.
That's great, thank you. It's always nice when a theme has a mountain in it, you know, and some wilderness. There we have it. And I thought we would just kind of walk through this together verse by verse. I think there's just rich, rich imagery in every verse. I'll set forth some of what I see there, but I'd also love to hear from you what resonates with you as we go along. Okay, so first verse. Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian. He led his flock beyond the wilderness. And beyond the wilderness actually is translated in the King James as the backside of the wilderness. Or no, excuse me, the backside of the desert. The backside of the desert is the place that is here called beyond the wilderness, which is kind of an interesting, beyond the wilderness even. Not just into, but beyond the wilderness. Up a mountain. A flock, I'm noticing all the wool around here and so on. But you know, we hear always with the Christmas story how menial the work of the shepherd is. And it's a person going about his work and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. Which I doubt that he would have known at the time was the mountain of God. I mean, it became the mountain of God with this speaking, I think. So I should check on that. See, that's not the same mountain that Abraham and Isaac went to. No, I don't think so. No. Okay. And there the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, and the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not turned up. And when God saw that he had turned aside to see, right, then God spoke. So I'm really intrigued here with this turning aside to see. It's almost as if whoever had turned aside to see, God would have spoken to. And, you know, that wasn't necessary that, you see, by the language, it could be that a person would walk by it and not turn aside to see. But God, when he saw that Moses had turned aside, then God spoke. And this openness to turn aside and to look and to see what is there, it's one that seems to me we, you know, can get lost in our culture of many, many images, none of which may particularly stand out as important. The whole notion of turning aside to see and being curious, wondering, what is this, says Moses, what is happening here? It seems to me as a very, very rich image. And one of my hopes for the summer is that we will encourage people to turn aside and see. One way of looking, if you see a burning bush, one way of seeing it would be just to see the bush. You know, not to deal with the fire. And a bush is a wonderful thing in itself, rooted, part of the ecosystem, you know, converting sunshine and water into foliage that becomes food for someone, something, a wondrous thing. Or possibly, in another point of view, a source of pulp. You know, you can objectify a bush and see it for its commercial value. You see it as a wondrous physical thing, as a commodity. On the other hand, there's the fire. And, you know, many people are very interested in the fire in the sense of the spirituality, the godness of it, the godness that is there in that bizarre clump of fire that's there in the bush. But then some people see spirit and don't see the real world, don't see the natural world. Okay. So how do we hold these intentions? And the idea of a burning bush that is blazing but not consumed seems to me a very rich way of holding together the actual material world and God's spirit, which infuses it. And in a sense, this is a sacramental way of seeing the world, right? Seeing, really seeing the ordinary, really understanding it's just a bush, and yet really seeing God's presence as well. And one of the, when I got this phrase, take off your shoes, of course I Googled it and found some interesting things. And one is an article by Brother David Steindl Rast, a Benedictine author, probably known to some of you, who it's called Sacramental Life, Take Off Your Shoes. And let me just read a little bit here, which I think is says very well what I'm trying to say. So of course, the sacramental life also, going to church, then we think a lot about the God part of that union and the challenges to bring it out of there into the material world. Right? We have the sacraments. So he says, rightly understood, the sacraments of the Christian churches are not self-contained boxes conveying divine grace. They are focal points of that divine fire which makes all life sacramental. It is hard to imagine someone truly understanding the Lord's Supper, for instance, without having learned to look with the eyes of the heart at the robin gulping down an earthworm to feed her young in the nest. Making these connections between what we take to be God's action and what's the material world. The universal law that life must give its life to feed new life simply mirrors the surpassing mystery that through God's love we have life, God's life, by the very death of God. This mystery of the Eucharist comes into focus whenever a community shares a meal mindfully, gratefully. And you hear this overlapping of the godly and the material in our daily lives, in our worship, and in the natural world. Biblical tradition sees with particular clarity that sacramental life is realized in time in history. This is how the rabbis put it. Unless Moses had been taking care of the sheep, he never would have come upon the burning bush. Mm-hmm. Unless we serve life in the give and take, which this involves on all levels, we shall never discover its sacramental power. That togetherness in which life, sacramental life, is rooted includes the dimensions of time, of history, of struggle, of suffering, of service. Moses not only came upon the burning bush in the midst of his daily work as a shepherd, but this vision compelled him to struggle for the liberation of his people. Okay. So we have an epiphany of God there in this burning bush, but it leads, it's very much part of the material world, and it leads out. You know, you find it in the midst of ordinary life, and it leads beyond itself into ordinary life. And similarly, the sacramental life of worship, Christian worship, I think, has the same effect. You know, it's real water, and that real water that we use in baptism is part of the whole water of the watery planet, right? It's part of the ecosystem. We get it from a local source here. But it joins, that water is joined to the waters of the earth. And by naming it, by seeing its holiness within the sacrament of baptism, I think we're also called to see its holiness beyond that place. And then when we're out in the world, seeing water sustain, nourish, cleanse, wash, then we understand baptism better too. You know, so
and
it goes
destroy.
Both ways.
I mean, just thinking
water.
About
oh,
the
yeah.
tsunamis.
Good.
And you know, a year ago,
right.
We experienced that here.
Great.
You know, that pales, according to...
Great.
You know,
yes.
But that power of it, connecting us, again, connecting
right.
us to the...
Right.
The same waters.
Yes.
The same.
Yeah. 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 So there's that whole sacramental conjunction that we see in that water. And... You know, we speak of it theologically in the bread, in the wine, but also, I'd say, in the gathered people, mm-hmm. it becomes a sacramental reality that we can use to understand human community rightly understood as well. Okay. So, and so this is kind of the worship theme, the worship portion of the theme. Gordon Lathrop says, liturgy heals our eyes so we can see the world as it is, held into holiness by God. It heals our eyes when we see, for instance, bread and name it as gathered. Name it liturgically as gathered from the grain and into one. And share it in a way that is equal and forgiving, then we kind of see eating in a new way as well. So liturgy heals our eyes. I think poets also, I mean, liturgy heals our eyes, poetry also heals our eyes in some of these ways. There are a lot of, there's so many poems that talk about the brilliant presence of God within material things. And I didn't have time to go to the library and get them all, but people can help me. Gerard Neely Hopkins has several that do this.
Yeah, God's grandeur.
Yes, God's grandeur. If anyone
can. And it's about what happens when we wear shoes and separating us from the earth.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Elizabeth Barrett Browning's famous, "What every blackberry bush is tinged with God's spirit." And anyway, we could. There, I think that poetry helps us to see the world in that way as well, and visual art can also help us to see the world in its holiness. You know, it's still the real world, but there's a different dimension that we can bring to it. So I think that's part of what the burning bush says to me. Do you want to say anything about this? I'd love to hear what the burning bush says to you. But some of this is what the burning bush.
It's a sustainable bush.
A sustainable bush. Great, great, great. Yeah.
When you talked about the water, I also thought that we are all predominantly water, physically speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And if
yeah.
we're going to talk about water as holy, literally, yeah. when we look at another person, there is holy water
mm-hmm.
standing in front of us to wash us,
yeah.
to destroy us maybe, to destroy a part of us,
right.
to challenge us in that way.
Mm-hmm.
The water in one another is, for some reason, that's the first time it's ever struck me that
yeah.
baptismal waters unite us and we're all,
mm-hmm.
the natural unity of water I've always kind of gotten, but.
Yeah, that's great. And, there are similar things that you can do with warmth and fire. You know, all the way from the Big Bang to the sun that provides all our energy. And it's fired away in our cells at this moment, that burning. Sustainable energy, right? In that sense. But also think of another thing the burning bush says to me is think of blazing for our passions,
mm-hmm.
our passion for justice, our passion for art, for one another. Blazing, but not being consumed.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's what I was thinking, the connection
yeah.
to last summer's theme.
Yeah.
You find that energy within you, and when you find that energy, it doesn't consume you. It
uh-huh.
fills you up, it gives you more.
Yeah, yep. You don't want to stop blazing.
Yeah.
We want to find that blaze. We also don't want to be consumed. Yeah. So.
And it's interesting,
yeah.
though. I mean, I think what else is around the bush and it's burning? And I think a lot of people's first reaction was, "Oh my gosh, I got to put this out."
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Uh-huh. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. That's great. Yeah. But what does God say? God says, out of the burning bush, then, two things. Come no closer. Maybe that was to stop that, Brad, to stop that. Don't mess with this. This is something to leave alone. Come no closer.
First he called him by name. Wasn't that the theme of the summer before?
Yeah, that was 2001. Does he say?
2001?
Yes. Moses, wonderful. And he says, and he has the right answer, right?
Yeah, here I am.
Here I am. Good answer, Moses. That's often in call stories. Yeah, great. Calls him by name. He says, come no closer. So there's not like a, a mushy, let's all be holy here. You know, so there is a kind of terrifying character to this epiphany, right? There's a, it's got a commanding voice, right? It's not a soft, easy kind of holiness, you know, it's kind of terrifying. And Moses is going to be afraid by verse 6. He's trembling.
Well, there's the fierceness of it. But then go back, I wonder what, how that connects back to being beyond the wilderness. And that feels fierce too.
Yes, it does. It does. The backside of the desert. Yeah.
This may be carrying it too far, but it seems like in the most hopeful sense, that's what we would like Holden to be, is a burning bush that people turn aside to see. And you really literally, in order to do that, you have to come here first. And if you didn't come, you might miss.
Yeah, right.
But even so, the bush is burning, or the message of what happens here at Holden is happening, whether other people turn aside or not.
Yeah.
And you want it to be paid attention to.
Right, right. That's great.
What's happening here, you want to pay attention to.
Do you think it's possible even to come here and not to really to see
the bush?
The burning bush.
Mm-hmm. I think it is possible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that would be my deepest hope, is that we just find ways to help more people get it. You know, and there's something about this also, take off your shoes, like one less layer of stuff. Mm-hmm. Separating and isolating us from the earth. Let's just leave that stuff back and get one layer closer. And then we'll take off our socks. We'll take off some, you know. So it's you know, how do we help more people get it? That's part of it. Involve them in the environmental life of the place in a way that they can take home with them.
Well, and something what you said made me think that all worship should be like this encounter with this fire, with this bush, and that if worship is encountering God, it should be sort of a mystical experience like that. I mean, it should have that dimension to it somewhere, and not just the flatline kind of worship.
Possible, yeah. That, you know, but in a sacramental way, I totally agree, but it's in the real actual bodies of the people there, and the actual tones that we can draw from the instruments, you know, the actual voices and things that, and then that the assembly itself becomes a burning bush. You know, it's not like we're the assembly looking at a burning bush in worship, but that the assembly itself is a sacramental presence. Gordon Lathrop says that the chief Christian sacrament is the assembly itself. Mm. The people being together in this way is the sign of God's presence. More than water, more than stuff. Yeah.
It's my experience with making art for the worship space in conjunction with music and with liturgy and with maybe dance that happens and the people. I mean, it's amazing that there's so many coincidental richnesses that layer up that are greater than the sum of the whole.
Uh-huh.
And that to me is where the mystery is. I mean, it's definitely in the people. It's definitely in all these parts.
Uh-huh.
But together it's way amazing.
Yeah. Does it always ignite? You know what?
Good question. And does it ignite for everyone?
Does it ignite for everyone?
I was going to say, for some people, for some people, the fire experience, that thing is just, woohoo, we're revved up and ready to go. Mm-hmm. For other people, they're just like, that was cheesy.
Yes.
Or that was sexy.
Yes.
Or,
right.
Left, you know, for some, whatever it is, leaves it flat. Yeah. And so I think that's the major challenge in worship, is that I agree, Scott, the hope is to have it be kind of a fiery experience every time, except that you can't really do that.
Yeah. Maybe that's in part the connection with the worldly, because what the person brings with them to the space and to the worship is definitely going to affect how either make it meaningful or cheesy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you wouldn't want to judge by the decibel level, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's clear. But these are things to think about. You know, of course, fire is a transforming presence also. I did, you know, when we were talking about theme, a lot of it, and especially with when I was here in September, the actual fire was down lake was very much on our minds. Mm-hmm. And does that seem okay with this, to have mm-hmm. a burning bush in our theme?
I think it didn't burn.
Yeah, it didn't burn. It didn't burn. It did not consume. Right. It was not consumed. It didn't even burn. Right.
I think it's a good risk.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Well, that was a conversation we did have before when we had the fire and water, mm-hmm. called by name fire and water values.
Yes,
and we discussed whether it would be a good thing or not a good thing to have the picture of a forest fire in our worship space. Mm-hmm. And I think it was enriching.
Yes, yeah. Well, there is a vulnerability that comes from the kind of connection to the earth that we're talking about, mm-hmm. and that comes with simply not wearing shoes even across the house, you know, mm-hmm. that's a small thing, but yeah.
I actually think that not wearing shoes is one of the most vulnerable things we do. Like you and I have talked about washing feet mm-hmm. in worship. Mm-hmm. People's response to that is so powerful, mm-hmm. so often. Some people could care less. But some people that do not touch my feet.
Yeah.
You can touch my hands, you can touch my arms, you can touch my head, you can touch my face, you can touch mm-hmm. me just about anywhere. Mm-hmm. Do not touch my feet. So there is an intimacy, comfort level, vulnerability thing there mm-hmm. that is pretty powerful.
You know, that's really true. In my book Receiving the Day, when I'm writing about Maundy Thursday, I write about a friend who washes my feet, and it was right in the middle of my own divorce. I was just very much like, you know, that someone could touch me in that way. It was so caring and so wonderful. Many, many years ago.
We read that in The Best Fur's Not Lying.
That
Katie, mm-hmm. yeah, that section
uh-huh,
of your book.
Uh-huh. But it really is a very healing, wonderful thing. If you allow yourself to be vulnerable in that way, you can say, yes, I have a need to be washed. You
know? Creating a space where people can be that vulnerable, I think, is one of the hardest things.
Yes, right. To do. Right, right. But you know, that gesture, the movements of foot washing in Scripture, and I was going to point to Luke 7, the end of Luke 7, mm-hmm. where the woman of the city, the sinful woman, comes into the house of the Pharisee and washes Jesus' feet. Mm-hmm. And let me just read one verse that he says. He says, do you see this woman? Says mm-hmm. Jesus, I entered your house. You gave me no water for my feet, but she has bathed my feet with her tears and dried them with her hair. You gave me no kiss, but from the time I came in, she has not stopped kissing my feet. You did not anoint my head with oil, but she has anointed my feet with ointment. Now, therefore, I say her sins are forgiven. I mean, and then in John 13, mm-hmm. Jesus, you know, he just gets out a basin and puts a towel around his waist and says, okay, I'm going to wash your feet. And Peter says, like the people,
no
don't
way.
Touch me. Mm-hmm. You know, you're too great to do that to me. But then Jesus prevails and washes the feet of the disciples. In a sense, you could say that gesture of foot washing, I'm going to say it's the enactment of actual mercy. Mm-hmm. It is a way of acting out and embodying mercy in a very personal and yet traditioned way.
Mm-hmm. I was just thinking how in reflexology, the foot has the whole person, and by touching the feet, every organ, every part of the body is affected, mm-hmm. if you know how to touch it right. Uh-huh. That's the thing, we should get a reflexology foot poster.
Chris Larson is going to bring one. Chris Larson is a member of Holden's board, who's a physical therapist, and she says, ooh, I have this great model of the foot, and I'm going to bring it. It has all these little colors on it and points. And I said, well, you've got to at least do a Madden's, you know. This would be very good.
For the back of the t-shirt.
Oh. Oh. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I just also had the idea, wouldn't it be cool if we had a weekly foot washing service, a healing service? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like instead of Conklin or in addition to Conklin.
Right, as an optional thing.
Mm-hmm. Extra view.
But for those who would come, that might be wonderful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That might be wonderful. Yeah.
Or involve the spiritual directors in that or something.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Along with reflexology, it is true what I said in Vespers tonight, that your feet mm-hmm. are the physical part of where your body stores your emotions, all those things that you connect with your grounding community, your family, your congregation.
Really?
Huh. So if you have issues with mm-hmm. your family, they're going to live in your feet. If you have issues with your congregation, they're going to be in your feet. So it's kind of an interesting, at least according to a few mm-hmm. sources. It would be an interesting thing, not just to have the chart, but to have someone who knows reflexology in here. Along the lines of a spiritual director, truly, to mm-hmm. say, you know, I'm pushing this.
Mm-hmm.
What are you thinking about? And it could be a real healing. I mean, that could be an immensely healing thing.
Well, maybe we should put a little, we should, as part of orientation, say, if anybody's a reflexologist, would you tell us? Because that is interesting. You know, another thing is the feet are often where people who live in poverty, especially people who don't have homes and mm-hmm. can't get off their feet safely, where their illness emerges or where they're really vulnerable to infection.
Because they don't have a home to
home.
Because they don't have a place to get them up off the mm-hmm. up on a bed, you know, and to not be standing on them and so on. And so Open Door, which I know as we get their newspapers, a very good homeless ministry in Atlanta, has a foot clinic a couple times a week. And one of the things that they collect from those who support that ministry is socks.
Mm-hmm.
And they give out fresh socks.
Fresh socks.
To all the people who come there, in addition to the food. So in that sense, when my notes, it's, you know, another thing that this theme says, I think, is deep hospitality. I mean, that in the Asian culture, in Japan and Korea at least, people go into houses, and when you are invited into a house, you take off your shoes.
Iceland too.
Wonderful, okay. And here, it's kind of a little bit of take off your shoes, put up your feet, take a load off, rest. Be comfortable, be yourself, be here, you know, and there's that kind of a colloquial American way. Mm-hmm. And to think of the kind of hospitality, that if we could offer that to those who come here, that would allow people to, hey, take off your shoes, you know, to be comfortable. And then also, as we've been saying, to be vulnerable, to trust that, to allow someone else to wash their feet. If you think of volunteer staff coming and all kinds of transition, what would it mean to say, you know, take off your shoes?
I was just thinking, but in addition to t-shirts, we should have socks.
Oh, great!
With the reflexology thing
on. Yeah.
Yeah. For HV.
Yeah. Well, great. Wonderful. Wonderful. Yeah.
I see another hospitality area with the feet is elderly people.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Cutting their toenails is kind of something that is very intimate and vulnerable, but they can't do and they need help with.
Yeah. Wow.
Thinking in Islam, they take off their... I mean, they wash their feet before they go into the mosque in traditional cultures. So it's one of they wash their hands and feet. Mm-hmm.
It's a form of radical hospitality, mm-hmm. I think, which is not just kind of a warm welcome, but we accept you with your, you know, your broken toenails mm-hmm. kind of approach to another person.
Isn't there something in Hebrew tradition about reconciliation, taking off the shoes? I'm not very smart.
Mm-hmm. Let's look and see.
I think there is something, I can't remember what that is. But
is that where righteousness and peace shall kiss each other? There might be something in that passage in the Psalms.
Yeah.
Look up all the shoes. Look up all the shoes. I haven't looked up all the shoes.
You pick off a shoe.
And yeah, it's a sign of.
It's a sign of.
Uh huh.
I don't remember it. Another one of my favorite verses is "How beautiful are the feet of those who preach the gospel mm-hmm. of peace."
Yes. The first week of the summer, which begins June 5th, Dan Erlander is doing Bible study, and he's got all his feet passages, including that one. And it goes, you know, Moses takes off his shoes, Isaiah takes off his shoes, so-and-so takes off his shoes, and he goes right on through and has all the, and including those passages.
We don't have to suppress the Song of Solomon. How beautiful are thy feet with shoes, O princess daughter?
With shoes?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Shove that under the table.
Okay, well, let's talk about, we've been talking about bare feet, but let's talk about shoes for a minute, you know, which shoes become, I mean, that's almost, isn't that that she's a privileged woman, or that she would be adorned and would have the covering that the, that all women might not have? I'm like a princess, or...
Well, I think
in that context,
it's just the lover's way of responding to the woman's beauty.
Okay, yeah.
But it would be a sign of privilege, I believe, because to walk around in silk slippers means you're not really going anywhere.
Uh-huh.
You're not walking on the gravel roads, on the dusty trails. You're carried around in a sedan. So you are prestigious, beautiful, desirable.
And then in our own time, you know, Imelda Marcos's impressiveness was signified by her the shoes in her closet. And when people make fun of, you know, a certain stereotype of American consumerism, it is the woman trying on 100 pairs of shoes. And in fact, you know, not having shoes is one of the things that happens to those who are poor, right? And in fact, you know, people in poverty all over the world stitching shoes for American feet. And then last weekend in Seattle, the front page of the paper had a picture, maybe some of you saw it, of piles of discarded American clothing, and the people who are trying to recycle that and sort it out and send it to impoverished people elsewhere for small. And sometimes that's helpful, that infuses those economies with something to trade, but in many ways it also suppresses local ways of covering feet and of developing ways to provide their own shoes. And so you could do a whole, and I'm sure people will, like Larry Rasmussen is doing that first week with Dan Erlander, and one of his sessions is called Take Off Your Nikes. You know, about globalization and shoes and justice. So there is the take off your Nikes, you know, as part of that too.
Scott Gustafson, in his book Biblical Amnesia, which everybody who lives here has typically quoted, but talks about the difference it makes between who says the thing. If God says, take off your shoes, this is holy ground, that is a sacred moment. And I've been, when you talk about piles of discarded clothing, I can't help but think of Auschwitz, Birkenau, where there are piles of shoes,
there
and
are,
it was someone else saying, take off your shoes, because we're going to demean you, and we're going to oppress you.
Yes.
We're going to get rid of anything you have that remotely is comfortable or helpful or, you know.
Right. That's very interesting. Yes, in the Holocaust Museum, there's a whole room the size full of shoes. Just full of shoes.
On a completely separate tangent, I don't even know if this is true, so it's sort of a stretch, but there's that whole red hat club when I'm an old woman, I will wear purple. And for some reason, it strikes me that in there, she's either going to wear purple shoes or no shoes. She's going to go barefoot because she can. And she doesn't have to be prim and proper and wear those tight-fitting heels anymore. Mm-hmm. She can just let her feet go. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if that's in there, but kind of the liberty, the unrestrainedness of not wearing shoes.
Yeah. Our kids are always taking off their shoes. You just, when you have 4-year-olds, you just can't keep shoes on them. It's just...
I have one small hesitation about it that maybe could be said. Sometimes I know that in the case of the very elderly with circulation problems and things, there are a few people who really are not comfortable in their feet unless their shoes are supporting their feet.
Right, right.
And there may need to be something said, you know, that if you are one of those people whose feet burn, and I think they will be the rare exceptions, but to make a nod toward that, to be aware of it.
Let me also say that in the second week of the summer, we have really one of the leading theologians of disability coming. And she herself, I don't know what caused it, but she has a limp and uses support to walk. She's coming with her family, and she teaches at Emory. She's one of Ben Stewart's teachers now. He recommended her. Nancy Eastland. She's never been to Holden before, but she's a Lutheran from the Southeast and is excited to come. And she writes about disability and worship and has been a major person resourcing churches that have tried to deal with. So we're not talking about all feet being whole.
Not all feet are equal.
Right, not all, right.
This weekend, and I'm not going to remember the total thing, it was on a public radio story, and I think it was from some Central American country, where you could always find shoes in these piles of clothes that get sent. And that some of the clothes and shoes were people who had been killed, maybe they disappeared. And that when people would come to these street side stands to buy.
Naomi read that.
Oh, that's what it was. Yeah. What was that? And that would come, that's what it was. It sounded like an NPR story. That they would come and buy the shoes back of their loved ones and then bronze them or keep them on a shelf because they found something out there disappeared.
Well, it does say something, you know how people do this with baby shoes, how you put yourself into a shoe. You know, it becomes only fits you. But so we're really getting at some of the kind of the shadow side of the theme, which is really interesting too, and really need to watch for. But that opens up other kinds of rich conversations, I think.
And what does the footprint of the baby mean? You know, don't they take footprints of babies when they're born?
Uh-huh. Yeah, they do it still.
It's identifying as a footprint.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's something. Identity.
Let's see. There were other parts. Any other ideas that you hear as you think about the burning bush or the standing on holy ground or any of that?
The traditional greeting in Swahili culture in East Africa, when you greet an elder, you always say shikamu, which means I hold your feet.
Oh, interesting.
Well, that would be fun.
Great, interesting. I brought out the dancing servant because, of course, the towel and the basin usually refers to foot washing. Mm-hmm. And the dancing, Emily helped us to see how that groundedness is important. But I think feeling the mercy in foot washing is, there's mercy here and there's also justice in this theme. And there's lots of groundedness, I hope. And it may just go in 100 different directions, and we may wonder. But I think it will probably.
I don't know where you would want to go with this, but I know in the cowboy culture or a hardworking ethic, you don't want to be separated from your shoes.
Uh-huh.
You want to be ready to move, to
feed,
and dive boots. Yeah, so you dive boots on, kind of thing. But there's a. Brought in, but it's kind of a way of not allowing yourself to be so vulnerable that you can be overcome.
Yeah.
And in that same vein, in the cowboy culture that you refer to, it is only the people that you're very closest to that you allow to take off your boots, because after you're on your feet all day, your feet are swollen, and so you usually need help. But
I had a friend. He was Orthodox Jewish person, and the only people that were left in his family after World War II were his mom and his dad. They had no other living relatives that he knew of. And he told me one time his parents slept with their shoes, and I thought he meant literally until about late 50s, they literally slept with their shoes right, ready to flee. They were in Montreal. That really brought the whole image of shoes is kind of a security thing, and it lets you get away, you know.
The other thing, as we look beyond the end of this text, the next thing that happens is God says, I have observed the oppression of the people in Egypt. So there's another kind of attention, another kind of observing that God is doing also. And so as we think about observing the burning bushes in our midst, also listening to the cries of those who are oppressed and attending to those and having this be, having a ascending element, you know, that we will go down, and this could be in the video or something, you know, this is time on the backside of the desert, but it does end when you, you know, it will be sent out on a journey from here as well.
Well, you know, I always have to like read before, read after to, like I never read this before or something, and it always has a new thing.
Yeah.
So naturally after God observes and God makes promises and then the staff goes into the snake and vice versa, and all of these miraculous, wonderful things, then when the Lord says, now go, I will help you speak and I'll teach you what to say, and Moses said, oh Lord, please send somebody else to do it.
That's right. Who am I that I should do these things? Yeah, a man of slow speech. So, yeah. But there's something in him that, you know, that God saw that did have to do, I think, with this capacity to give attention to God's presence.
I think that might be an important piece, that God sees the oppression. It's not just that we see it and want to do something about it. The reason we want to do something about it is because God has seen it and has put it into us to do something about it. And that it's our job then to see it not through our own eyes, but through God's eyes, as God sees it. So what we, even some of the things that we name oppression, that might be our own eyes. So, you know what I mean?
No, that's interesting.
It's, the important part is that God sees it, not that I see it.
Bob Ekblad is coming to do a Bible study at the end of the summer, and I remember when he was here one August, I think it would have been 2002, and I was here with some of the Way to Live kids, and the women from Genesis House were here.
Oh yeah,
remember them? And he was doing Exodus, and he did this passage, and he taught everybody the Hebrew word, which I've now forgotten, for God observed. And then he would talk about situations of injustice in our world and say, God observed. You know, and there was like this whole sense that God was aware of the injustice of the world, and it was putting that awareness into us that was, it was really powerful in this room. That anyone else remembers that, but the women were really excited, and our teenagers were very excited about that. It was very empowering. Anybody want to add anything or raise other dimensions? I think we'll keep having other, you know, more thoughts as we continue. Some have asked me to recommend books that might be, or other resources that might be interesting for people around this. Summer. Diane has pointed out that we're much more likely to read them if it's a novel or stories or something than a treatise, and I think that's very sensible. And one that I was going to recommend revisiting is Annie Dillard's Pilgrim at Tinker Creek. She views the natural world with great attentiveness. And there's one passage in particular where she's just out for a walk and she sees the tree with lights in it. And it's a really changing experience for her, understanding her place in the world. And it's a little bit, I don't know, it only occurred to me recently that it might be like the burning bush. Barbara Kingsolver, many of her works are concerned with some of these same themes. her book, little book of essays, Small Wonders, which has been in the library. And Prodigal Summer is one of her very ecological novels, but there are others as well. I haven't read all of them. Wendell Berry is very interesting on this point, I think, and very rich and deep. I love his novel, Jaber Crow. Mm-hmm. And his Sabbath poems. Paul Rohde just told me about a novel, I wonder if anybody's ever heard of it, called The Work of Wolves.
Oh, that was cool.
The Work of Wolves. Sounds good. I'll get it when I get home and see. Apparently it's a new novel that he's really into right
he's
now.
He's got another one that he's going to teach on when he's here or wants to do some stuff. And I'm not going to think of it, but we should get that.
Oh, good.
Title.
Okay. Great. And in the treatise department, Gordon Lathrop's book, Holy Ground, I think is just a lovely, lovely book, which is full of rich images for worship and for music and art and so on, too. So, I also think that some of the literature and ecology talks would be worth listening to, especially Ben Stewart on The Earth We Carry. Mm-hmm. It's about the human body as the earth we carry. And I thought that was really profound. So, are there other ideas? I think we're tired. But are there other ideas or thoughts that are objections or images that spring into mind? I think that the very last verse in the Exodus 3:1-6 that. And Moses hid his face and was afraid. And we don't want to domesticate this burning. That's part of it, I think. One more thing I would want to add.
We talked recently after our Epiphany bonfire about how we do way more worship outside in the winter than we do in the summer. So we stand outside and freeze in the winter.
Yeah.
And then when it's beautiful outside, we go and sit inside.
Yeah.
And so one thing I want to work on, and this is something you should probably be aware of because you'll be talking to some of these people too, is thinking of ways to move us outside.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sound is always an issue with that, but if we start early and are intentional about it, we can work on different amphitheater kind of settings where we can, you know, try to create spaces where we can worship with 400 people around.
Mm-hmm.
And be outside, because if this is our theme,
yeah,
we should take off our shoes and stick them in the grass and
right.
have worship there instead
right.
of on a hardwood, you know, floor.
Right.
Huh.
No, I agree.
We used to have a weekly outside, right?
We did
by the jacuzzi and use that kind of use the walkway as the kind of focal.
All right.
Yeah. It was hard in that. I mean, the setup was hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And elderly people sometimes had trouble negotiating it. There weren't enough seats for everyone, and
yeah.
you know, it can be inhospitable.
Yeah.
I would wonder about optional things at certain points. You know, meditation walks.
Right.
And Susan Ballinger is working on a lot of science teaching.
Mm-hmm.
Is really committed to getting as many sessions outdoors as we can.
Mm-hmm.
So doing guided learning about creation outside. And I hope that some others will do that as well.
And the Hike House has some stuff that they started last year, and Sonia, Tanya.
Barnett, right, did a...
Left some stuff, meditation stuff.
Yeah.
For that.
Yes, right. Hike House did a Sunday afternoon meditation hike.
One time it was like a parade.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was like 35 people going on this meditation walk too.
Yeah.
There was a big request in Albriendo with the committee that they didn't want science class to be inside. They wanted it to be outside, and they wanted it to combine hiking for all ages.
Great.
So that's
great. Great.
There's the Albriendo person who's really gifted in that area. Susan actually, they both live in Wenatchee. They were talking to each other.
Good, great, great. And that's really, really important. Yeah. There are all kinds of things we can think about too. For example, when the theme looked like it was going towards holy ground, I was thinking of the mine as holy ground. To try to admit the damage done mm-hmm. here, you know, to the environment.
You didn't mean a hole in the ground.
As well. Yes, it's a hole in the ground. Yes. Yes, little pond there. I wrote out 5 hopes for the summer, which maybe I should just leave with people, but kind of summarize this. But I think that there's, if your experience is like mine, when you have this in mind, it's going to start kind of
showing up
perky.
Everywhere.
And I hope that's true. I just wrote these out this afternoon, my hopes for the summer, and see what you think, and maybe add some others. That villagers will glimpse a burning bush and allow themselves to be attentive to God's call. Just that they'll be open and attentive, whether that comes in another person or on a hike. That Holden's environmental commitments will shine visibly, and that many villagers will embrace these and change their own practices when they get home. So it's not Holden as holy ground, it's this earth mm-hmm. as holy ground, back even in Northwest Indiana. That village worship will guide this community as we name and celebrate and respond to all these elements, but here I say God's fiery presence in the world, for the sake of the world. That all villagers will experience a warmth of hospitality that encourages them to take off their shoes, to wiggle their toes, to dance, to risk stubbing their toes, to allow others to wash their feet, and that they discover in this hospitality a call to offer hospitality to others here and down lake. That worship and sessions and village life generally will stir up a willingness to offer attention to God's call to work for liberation, and to shared exploration about how that call both embraces and challenges us personally and in our communities here and down lake. How can we burn with this passion and not be consumed? And I think that is really what Lutheran Volunteer Corps are planning to have their retreat together about. How do we continue to live out these burning commitments which are terrifying in a way and difficult, but that won't stop burning, you know, and not be consumed. I think that's part of their concern as well. So,
is there a shoe ministry that we could support for their offering?
There is.
There's several. I know we can guide our feet. We did the prosthetics.
Yeah.
Of that label.
Yeah, but here, take off is sort of not the right
note.
We did the feet. I think hospitality is close. Some kind of environmental, holy ground.
Yeah.
Work.
Yeah.
But that'll be interesting to think about. I've started talking, and I hope that people in the village for these remaining months will think about sessions or other ways, for instance, a foot washing service. As a part of it mm-hmm. each week on a voluntary basis. I mean, wouldn't it be incredible if we found that we couldn't fit people in? You know, it could happen. And other things that seem, the ways to share the work. I'm very open. I don't know how that will work, but I wish we could get more and more people involved in the actual work of the village. And mm-hmm. I think teenagers in particular would respond better to the village if they were doing something that was visible and notable to help out. Mm-hmm. And here I'm thinking maybe let them do a lot of painting, or, you know, put the biggest extrovert on the staff in painting and mm-hmm. let, you know, get some help or put it, you know, other things that they could really see.
Visible.
Yeah, that they could join in on. Or maybe some kind of environmental reclamation or something like that.
I got subject to it, they can help it.
That'll get them excited.
I've talked to Paul about, I mean, food justice is a lot, works, you know, very well into this, and at least the holy ground part.
And hospitality.
And the hospitality part, yeah. And Paul said that they'll work on some things, too.
When you mentioned going down lake and taking things out into the rest of our lives and work, I think of the line, the hymn line that I like to hold up, take my feet and let them be swift and beautiful for thee.
Oh, nice. Nice, yeah. That's
can
great.
Suggest going out and whatever we do, usually on our feet.
There's people are classed by their shoes also. You know, there's the Birkenstock crowd. Running shoes, cowboy boots. So to take off your shoes.
Good.
Around.
Yeah, it's equalizing. It puts us all on the same level, right, as it were. That's great. Oh, you've got some good images, Spinney. Sustainable energy and the leveling effect. That's great. Well, there are quite a few teaching staff members whose concern that is, you know, and who will deal with that. I haven't really put together the theme, but the theme isn't the whole summer either. Do you have some?
This more seems to me that whole as a place you talk about what people are going to take away.
Yeah.
If we're a nation at war, that ought to be pretty central in terms of what we're thinking about.
Yeah.
Well, the connection for me there is again back to last summer's theme. If you're treating the earth as sacred ground and all people as children of God, then you don't kill them.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty obvious there for me, an obvious connection of right relationship, holy ground. If you're turning aside, seeing the world as sacred, you don't do that.
Well, if in some liturgy you repeated the certain kinds of shoes that you want to remove, taking off your combat boots is a pretty effective image.
Yeah.
I think it would be pretty easy to, by next summer, to be not paying attention to this. The election would be over. It's possible. It would just be off people's radar.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's very good.
It'd be kind of cool to have a prayer around the cross where they were all kind different kinds shoes. Of shoes positioned around the cross.
Including army boots.
Yeah. Sandals, water sandals. Praying for the praying for the nations of the world. Theme or something.
Right.
Popped into Aggie Morris just mentioned it, but when we were at Michigan State, one of our dear, dear friends was a pottery major, and her senior project was she took molds of bare feet and she fired foot after foot after foot, and some of them were burnt looking, some had banana peels in them, and she would do the display of having the feet walk into a spiral or walk, you know, have them on the church pews coming up to the altar or walking through. I mean, you know, I've seen it put three different places. The artwork is fabulous.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
It would be a project
where we did that, and people could do it.
Yeah, it could make the thing or,
you know. Can you imagine Narnia doing something like
I was
too.
Thinking about that, just, you know, how common it was to have handprints of your children's very simple thing, but to have footprints.
You know, I also think of land that has had war on it, has been utterly desecrated. You know, you have some effort at least to desecrate the land.
barn door.
The footprint thing lends itself to, you know, what kind of a footprint are you going to leave? But we don't want to leave too big of a footprint here in the valley, because then we harm the valley beyond, beyond what nature can repair, perhaps. When you go out on a hike, you're not supposed to leave a footprint behind. You just take only pictures and leave only footprints, I guess, actually. Thank you. So how big is the footprint of your house?
Right.
I think those are interesting questions.
Right. And I do, well, you know Pam Fickenshire and her husband, I think.
Who's that?
Pam Fickenshire.
Pam Fickenshire?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. And her husband is an urban ecology guy. And they're going to do something with how we build and, and bring the ecological thing into the city, which is very important. Mm-hmm. It can get very... Yeah, we need to take that home to places that are not like this. So, I mean, we can say, well, we have to live carefully here because this is a wilderness area.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, we do, but we have to live carefully elsewhere as well. So,
thinking how much my kids love to run barefoot around here in the summer and how they can't do that at home because it's broken glass in our neighborhood. And in some of the neighborhoods.
Kids do well to run barefoot.
The other thing that I was thinking when you were talking about the illnesses from feet, where people don't have shoes, but in my experience when I've been in countries where maybe kids don't have shoes for a really, really long time, or where a lot of people don't wear shoes or can't wear shoes for different reasons, I have been incredibly jealous of how tough and strong people are by being barefoot most of their life, in terms of how fast they can walk over ground, you know, that there's something also about being shoeless that, at least for some, seems to create a strength or something.
Makes me remember being a kid, and I was always proud of the fact that I could never get my feet clean. They were so dirty that you couldn't clean them.
It makes me think of our piano tuner, who's with two kids that don't have arms, so that their feet are how they eat and move themselves and dress themselves.
And you know, we will need to be sensitive to those who don't have feet also. There are a few.
Observation of people without shoes there. In this one particular area, it was always referred to as the foothills of the Himalayas, where so many people carry these huge burdens without shoes. But then I'm saying about the foothills. This is sort of a foothill here of these mountains. You know, we're a valley. You know, that even the earth has feet.
Thank you for that.
I love these ideas that are coming forth from you. Please.